What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, listeners, and thank you for tuning in to the Eyewitness History Podcast. This is your host, Josh Cohen. This episode looks at a deathbed promise from a daughter to a mother, which leads the daughter on a journey to write about her grandfather, who was a famous war hero. But this journey had a terrible destination, the discovery that he was a Nazi war criminal. Today's guest is the daughter, Sylvia Foti, author of the book Storm in the Land of Rain. Her mother was dying, and she wanted to preserve family history, so she asked Sylvia to write a book about Foti's grandfather, Jonas Noreika, a famous World War II hero. Foti had no idea that in keeping her promise to her mother, her discoveries would bring her to a personal crisis, unearth Holocaust denial, and expose an official cover-up by the Lithuanian government that resulted in an internationally followed lawsuit. Jonas Noreika was a Lithuanian known as General Storm. He led an uprising that won the country of Lithuania back from the communists, only to have it fall under Nazi control. He was an official during the Holocaust and chief of the second largest region in the country during the Nazi occupation, yet he became a prisoner in a Nazi concentration camp. Foti set out to write a heroic biography about her famous grandfather, but as she dug ever deeper, she encountered so much evidence proving her flesh-and-blood hero was a Jew killer. Even she could no longer believe the lie. Now I give you Sylvia Foti.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolfe. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Okay, I'm here with Sylvia Foti. Sylvia, thanks for coming on the podcast with me.
Hi, Josh. I'm so happy to be here.
Hi, it's my pleasure. I'm excited to have you. I obviously want to discuss you, your background, definitely your book, The Nazi's Granddaughter, How I Discovered My Grandfather Was a War Criminal. Before we do, please tell our listeners briefly who you are and what you do.
Well, right now I'm a high school English teacher in Chicago, Proviso Math and Science Academy. I teach freshmen and seniors. I've been doing this for 17 years. Before that, I was a journalist for 20 years. And I grew up on the south side of Chicago in Market Park to a very Lithuanian family. And actually spoke Lithuanian before I ever spoke English. It was a very insular, tight-knit community. And I only started speaking English when I went to kindergarten because all my friends were Lithuanian. My parents' friends were Lithuanian. There was hardly any reason for me to speak English, you know, until I went to the American school. And so that's a little bit about my background. Yeah.
Excellent.
Oh, I wanted to say my book.
Yeah.
My book has been retitled to Storm in the Land of Rain as the paperback. So the paperback came out last year in 22, and the title you referenced, The Nazi's Granddaughter, is the hardback that came out in 21. So they actually took my original title because apparently, and I agree with this, I think when it's a very difficult subject like the Holocaust, somehow softer titles draw readers in a little bit more easily. So Storm is, my grandfather was called General Storm.
Yes.
And Land of Rain is what Lithuania is, Land of Rain.
Yehovah would translate into land of rain.
That's interesting. Thank you, Sylvia. That makes sense to me about the softer title. I've made the necessary notes here.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. So before we get into the book, I'd love to ask you, what was it that made you pursue journalism? And what was it like freelancing in Buenos Aires?
I love to write. Even in grade school, you know, I think teachers are so important. One of my only eighth grade teacher pulled me to the side and said, Sylvia, you should become a writer. And that always stuck with me. And my grandfather was a lot of things. And one of those things was he was a writer. My grandmother wanted me to become a lawyer like my grandfather, but I wanted to become a writer like my grandfather. And so he really inspired me also to become a writer as well. Buenos Aires was interesting. It was a trip. I was there for almost 2 years, still learning the language, but I wrote in English for the Buenos Aires Herald and the Argentine News. And it was my first journalism job. I had just graduated from Northwestern University and I lived with my aunt, who was my grandfather's sister at the time. And so as I was living with her, I was doing some freelancing. And it's a totally different culture. It seemed very different. It's a third world country. And I, grew up, and I felt very like I woke up when I realized how spoiled of a life I had here in the United States when I lived there. Just all kinds of little things, from bureaucracy to cooking meals to the type of home, washing clothes. I mean, at that time, I was there in 85, 86. I'm sure it's probably even more developed today, but back then it seemed very different to me.
Yes, yes, indeed. Thank you. So the book, Storm in the Land of Rain, begins with the deathbed promise. Please tell me about that and how this whole story begins.
Yeah, so it was the year 2000, and I was 38 years old at the time. I was still a journalist then. My mom had been working on a book about her father, my grandfather, ever since I could remember, like since the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Always collecting material on him, say she's going to write the book on him. And we talked about it a lot, but in the year 2000, she was only 60 years old and she got very, very sick, ended up in the hospital. And when I saw her, I was shocked because I could see how much she had deteriorated and I was worried she was dying. And she must have known she was. And that's when she took my hand and said, Sylvia, you have to write the book. And I just kind of freaked out because I knew the only reason she would tell me this is she knew she was dying. And, my first response was, no, you'll be fine. You're going to come out and you're going to write the book. And she's like, no, you have to. Everybody expects it. And she just wanted me to say yes. And I, was hoping I was just putting her mind at ease and that she would be fine in a few weeks. But I did say yes. And then that was it. That was the last conversation I had with her, because the next day I came back and she was in a coma for 2 more weeks and then she died. So that's how I got my story assignment, if you will, from my mother. I said yes to her on her deathbed.
Wow. I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you.
Yeah. So who was Jonas Noreika? And then also perhaps for our listeners, Sylvia, who might not know what was happening in Lithuania at the time of the war. Why was he important and known by the community?
Okay, so Lithuania, became a democracy right after World War I. And so from 1918 to the Soviet Union's occupation in 1944, 45, it had its independence. And then when World War II came, until 1940, the Soviets came in again, wanted to take it over. Then the Nazis came in a year later, 1941, and they were there for 3 years. And then again, 1944, the Soviets came in and they kept the country until like 1990. So I grew up while Lithuania was under the Soviet occupation. And, all the community talked about was Lithuania needs to be free again. Lithuania needs to be free again. And my grandfather fought very bravely against the communists. And so everybody considered him a hero because of how he fought against the communists. So in 1940, with the first communist occupation, the story I grew up with was he was kind of a leader in Žemaitija, the northwestern part of Lithuania, in fighting against the communists, and they won. They got the communists out of the country. The part that was sort of hidden from me was that this was done with the Nazis, and that really without the Nazis, they probably could have never gotten the Soviets out. So anyway, then in comes the Nazi occupation from 41 to 43. And that part had always been glossed over. That was never really talked about. All that I kind of really, that's basically the basis of my book, is what happened in those 3 years, most of the book. But what I grew up with was that he died as a martyr for Lithuania's freedom. He was killed by the communists, 1947. And he was 36 years old then only, very young man, but very sort of just had done so much in those short 36 years. You know, I don't think even if we live to 80, we will have done as much as he did. And now that he had to live through with World War II. And that's probably could be said for everybody from that generation in a lot of ways, you know. So he died in a KGB prison. He had been captured by the KGB, tortured, horribly, horribly tortured, and then executed after about 2 years, two bullets in the head, and then he was buried. And the reason he was brought into the KGB prison was he tried to unite all of the partisans in Lithuania to fight against the communists. And he called himself General Storm. This is the period of time where he called himself General Storm. And he was really only a captain in the army, but he gave himself this code name, General Storm, General Svetra. And he failed. You know, the partisans really didn't want to follow him. They preferred following somebody else. And he still didn't give up. He was still trying to do what he could do. But somebody gave him up. Somebody betrayed him. And then that's why he ended up in the KGB prison. And then, you know, the story was he died a martyr for the Lithuanian cause. And the other weird part of the story that I didn't put together until much, much later was he was in a Nazi concentration camp also for 2 years before he tried to get the partisans to fight against the communists. So here's what I grew up with. He died a martyr for Lithuania's freedom. He fought very bravely against the communists. He was even in a Nazi concentration camp. This man is a hero. And in 1997, you know, the country got its freedom back in 1997. I went to Lithuania with my mom and my brother, and the country gave my mom the highest, well, to my grandfather, the highest honor it could give to anyone posthumously, this cross of the Vytis. And my mom was there accepting it for the president of Lithuania, and I was by her side. My brother was by her side, and we were like, this is such a proud moment. And then 3 years later came that deathbed promise. So I thought I was just going to write a wonderful story about what a wonderful hero my grandfather was. That's what I thought.
Wow. It's incredible, Sylvia. Thank you for running through that. I appreciate it. Maybe just to throw a few years out there just for our listeners, if my years are correct here, it was 1940 when the communists took over the country. And then I believe it was 41 when the country was won back from the communists.
Reoccupied by the Nazis.
Indeed, yes. And then I think, as you pointed out, 1946, he was taken to the KGB prison and then, you know, passed away in 1947. Just to throw some years out for our history buffs.
Okay.
Excellent. So we went through researching. I appreciate that. So I'd love to go through then what the story really was. So, you know, obviously, you know, as you're trying to depict your grandfather as a human who contains, I would say, multitudes, right, as all of us are. Let me see. What do you think is the synthesized story that's closer to the true version of who he was? Does that make sense? I know you told my colleague Scott Rank a few years back that he was very nationalistic and wanted, as you pointed out, a free Lithuania.
Yeah, I think he and many Lithuanians today think this too. I mean, this is not ancient history. This is still very much alive as far as how people think and feel today among the Lithuanian community and many in Eastern Europe, I think, is that the communists were the enemies and that he did everything he could to free Lithuania from the communists. And he was very nationalistic and he would do whatever he had to do that. The problem is that, and I only understood this many years later, is that all Jewish people in Lithuania were all labeled as communists. Every single one. Every single one. And they were then labeled the enemy. And this gave license to my grandfather and others to kill them. So I think that's the short answer.
No, I appreciate it. And I want to talk a little bit about, I think it was 1941. Apologize if my notes are a little bit muddled here. But wasn't there an uprising in Lithuania the same day as Operation Barbarossa?
Yeah, it started the same day as Operation Barbarossa. So, and, you know, I had done a lot of research on my grandfather, and he was already working with the Germans to overthrow the communists. So he was working in tandem with the Germans already, as were other Lithuanians all throughout the country. And there, the Germans had promised Lithuania they would give Lithuania back its freedom. That was a lie. And Lithuanians somehow believed that lie. Maybe they had no other choice other than, they really had no other choice other than to believe that lie. And they assumed they would get the country back. That part to me is not, to me, not problematic as far as the morality behind all this. But the bad part to me is that Lithuanians became convinced through Nazi propaganda, and I think through their own anti-Semitism, that all Jews, no matter what age they are, the babies included, are enemies of the state, and they all must be eliminated, cleansed. And this is where the genocide comes in. And until recently, and I'm not the one to have like broke the story, I'm not the first one. Maybe I'm the one who'd like to break it in a bigger way, but I certainly wasn't the first, is that it has always, the story has always been, it was only the Nazis killed the Jews. And so kind of the shock to me was that Lithuanians played a very large role in this as well. And this was a shock to me. And I think it's still a shock to many Lithuanians today.
Yeah, very much so, Sylvia. I appreciate it. Can you talk about I did some research on this. I think it was all in, it was 8,000 Jews that were killed under your grandfather's watch. Sorry to put it that way, but, you know.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could run through some of that. The Cholet region, I'm apologize for the mispronunciation, Plunje?
Yes.
And so on. How did that work? Were they simply rounded up and shot? Were they taken into a ghetto first? Could you please run through that for our listeners?
Yeah. Well, right as that uprising was happening in June 1941, right before that, the Provisional Government of Lithuania came out with an edict saying, cleanse the whole country of Jews. And there are lots of Lithuanian signatures on this edict. My grandfather wasn't part of the Provisional Government, but he certainly heard what they said or read what they said. It was just common knowledge across Lithuania by this point among Lithuanians. And so he was the commandantus of that whole Plunje area. And by the time it came to July, there were 2,000 Jews living in Plunje. The town had 4,000 people. Half of the town were Jews. And within, like, say, the middle of July, July 12, 13, all the Jews were killed under his command. And so there were only two Nazis in Plunje. All of the killing was done by Lithuanians in that town. And they were put in a synagogue and kind of maybe for 1 or 2 weeks starved. You know, this was July. It was very hot, given no water, no food. People were dying. Bodies were just left to rot in that synagogue. So you can imagine the stench and the smell. And Jews were going out of their mind in there too. And then outside, Lithuanians would like be very sadistic and sort of play games with the Jews. You know, like it's called the devil's dance. They would take a tall Jew and a short Jew and tell them to balance a log on their shoulders and to dance. And if the log falls, they're going to shoot them. And so as they're dancing around with this log, Lithuanians are laughing. But then, of course, you know, it's designed to fall off with a tall and short man. And then it falls and then they shoot them. And then, you know, one of the stories is one of the Jewish women came out and said, stop doing this. You know, one of the Jews, I can't remember, was a tall or short, was an older Jew. And, you know, it was like really torturing them. And she told the Lithuanians to stop. So Lithuanians shot her. So that synagogue was right across the street from the police station, which became the headquarters of that area, of that Plunkett area, where my grandfather was working as a comandante. And there was a house that was formerly owned by a Jew next to that synagogue. And through my research, I found out that my grandfather appropriated that house, just took it over after the Jews left it free. It turns out that family of Jews had run away to Russia, but a lot of the Jews were just killed and left their houses free for the Lithuanians to take over. So that's what happened in Plungė. Now, Telšė, which was kind of like the headquarters of this whole region, I did not research intensively, but my grandfather was the head of that area too. And for the most part, the Jews were taken to the woods and shot. It was one by one by one. They were asked to dig a ditch, or Lithuanians dug a ditch. They were put around the ditch. They were shot so they could fall in the ditch naked for the most part. And that's how it was. There were no gas chambers in Lithuania. So everything was one by one by one like that. And most of it was done by Lithuanians themselves with their own guns, or guns given to them by the Nazis to kill the enemy. Or then in Šiauliai, it was the same thing. Šiauliai, they did have a ghetto. They had a couple ghettos. But those who were killed, and, you know, of course, it's the majority, were taken to the woods and shot.
Horrifying. Thank you for running through it, Sylvia. I really appreciate it. Very curious to ask you, let's see, how this was kept secret until now from you. You know, obviously, it wasn't common knowledge. I bet a lot of our listeners, you know, might not even be aware of the Lithuanian well of anti-Semitism at that time. So I suppose, why do you think it wasn't common knowledge until recently?
I think it was hidden. I think with the chaos of war, it was possible to just hide behind the Nazis. You know, there was no way for Germany to hide it. And America forced Germany to go through a denazification process. Mm-hmm. And that, for better or worse, helped Germany, you know, face what it did and what its role was. Now, none of this would have happened without the Nazis. But when they came into Lithuania and told Lithuanians to kill the Jews, there was no resistance. Absolutely no. It was like, okay, let's do it. What do we need to do? It was that fast. It was that quick. And it was that zealous. Mm.
To that end, Sylvia, I know we dug into it a little bit earlier, but I'd love to ask you maybe a bit more about your research, where you went, who you talked with. I know there weren't any concentration camps in Lithuania, but I just would be really curious to know about your resources.
Well, of all the perpetrators in Lithuania, I think my grandfather has a lot of documentation surrounding him, because I didn't get to Šiauliai. By August 5th of 1941, my grandfather became what is like essentially the governor of the Šiauliai region, which was the second largest region of Lithuania. And he had to sign a lot of documents, you know, to run that region. And of the 1,000 documents that crossed, you know, that he signed or that was sent to him, of those 1,000, about 100 concern the Holocaust. And of that 100, the worst one, you know, if you had to put them in a ranking from worst to, you know, least worst, they're all horrible, but, you know, most horrible one concerning the Holocaust is he signed a document where he called for all the Jews and half Jews in the Šiauliai region to be herded up, rounded up, and marched to Žagarė, which is, you know, a town that just borders Latvia, northern town that just borders Latvia. And he called for a ghetto to be created there, where they would be held. In that same document, he's already appropriating their property, saying that it needs to be registered and accounted for. And within 6 weeks of him signing that document, it ended up being on Yom Kippur, they were all murdered, 2,000, from babies to grandparents. So I had gone through those documents with researchers that helped me. And so to me, that what happened in Cholet is very well documented. Fulongar was mostly through interviews because there was very little documentation in Fulongar. He was not, you know, when I grew up, everybody told me he was the commandant. And then there was this Damianos Rauca who worked with him during that time. And he's the one who sent a lot of information to my mom. And I heard about him. And then I find, you know, after my mom's death, I met him and I spent a whole week interviewing him and talking to him to kind of recreate what happened in Plunga. Now, he hid from me what happened with the Jews.
Mm.
He was a nationalist who only talked about my grandfather being a wonderful hero. So I had to kind of infer. And I kept asking, well, what about the Jews? What about the Jews? Oh, your grandfather had nothing to do with that. It was somebody else who did all the killing and did all that. And I'm like, but he was, according to you, the commandantas. Like, how could he not know what was happening to the Jews? Well, those other men acted independently. That was his only response. You know, where in the military, in what country can men act on their own volition without the commander's approval? Is that possible? How can you kill 2,000? I could see maybe one.
Right.
Or two. 2,000? How does that happen? You know, without him being aware and him knowing. So anyway, it was a lot of interviews. And then I, you know, one surprising interview where I found out that he took over that Jewish house was from my aunt, who was 10 years old at the time. And she was the least, you know, I didn't know. She was like my biggest surprise. You know, it was just, I'm sitting there and I'm having lunch with her one day. And I had already been in Lithuania. It's my 7th week there. I had done a lot of research there. But what she gave me to me was like, it ended up being the climax of my book because she's the one who told me about that house that he took over and that she was babysitting my mom while in that house. And then she couldn't place the house because she couldn't leave where she was living. She was so sick. She lived on this third floor apartment and I couldn't get her to come down and like, I couldn't drive her even because she couldn't go down the stairs. So anyway, with her daughter's help and then the librarian in that region, this part's a miracle. I told the librarian what my aunt said, and the librarian said that she was doing a side project of cataloging all the houses that belonged to Jews during that time.
Wow.
This is where, I mean, this wasn't the first time, but I was like, there's an angel guiding me here.
Mm-hmm.
There's like, to me, this is like hand of God, you know, helping me do this because this part was just pure coincidence. I couldn't plan it this way, you know. So that's how I found that piece of the puzzle. And that's, you know, a lot of the story came together that way through these little pieces. Just, you know, I'm looking and I'm not a historian. I'm a journalist. I can think critically, but I don't, you know. A lot of Lithuanians, you know, true historians of Lithuania are not happy with me at all. They, you know, they just say I'm a granddaughter and I don't know what I'm doing and I don't know what I'm talking about. But I found what I found as a journalist. It's solid.
Interesting. And you know, I that was actually going to be my next question was what the feedback, let's call it, has been from Lithuanians. I imagine, as you point out, there's been strong pushback against you, you know, raising awareness for this issue.
Yeah, pushback's a very polite term.
Yes.
Yeah, I've heard some death threats.
Wow.
And just a lot of angry emails, hate mails. You know, at the beginning, they were trying to say I wasn't even his granddaughter. Like, I was making that up. You know, like, they're just grasping at straws one after another. And I did come out of nowhere because I worked on this story by myself very quietly because I was completely freaked out over what I was, and I knew how Lithuanians would react. I totally knew how they would react because I am one. I know I might have reacted the same way if somebody else. I don't know. And I was in denial myself for 10 years over this whole thing. I couldn't believe that it was my grandfather. It took me 10 years to get over just the psychological denial of all
right.
this and to finally face it. And then it took me another 10 years like to really get down and write it and do the research and write it. And that's when I was really deciding to just look into the Nazi era, because very few Lithuanians really looked into the Nazi era. A Lithuanian's mindset is like 99% the Soviet occupation. Because that was 50 years.
Right.
The Soviets tortured Lithuanians. And maybe the Nazi occupation took up like 1% of our brain. Because that was just 3 years.
Right. I wonder what that is, this sort of refusal to acknowledge history or tragedy in your past. You know, I'm thinking as you were talking about, you know, the Ottoman Empire, the Armenian Genocide and so on, and the refusal within Turkic lands to even talk about it, let alone acknowledge it, let alone apologize for it. Do you see that as a maybe a historical parallel to Lithuania?
I do. And only because I went through it by myself and coming to terms with this, I feel like it's more of a psychological issue than a straight out logical historical issue. There is no end to how crazy humans can be. And you can't confuse stories with facts. You know, facts have nothing to do with what you really feel happened. Emotions are everything, I have learned. Unfortunately, it should not be like that. But I think that when I was researching and coming to terms with what happened, and I think for many Lithuanians, it's just more psychological.
Yeah, I understand that. That makes sense to me. I have just a few questions left, Sylvia, and then you're no longer my prisoner, I promise. You mentioned it a little bit ago, but I think I'll ask you clearly. I would imagine, you know, obviously this would be a long process of reexamining your past, sort of retroactively reexamining someone who you thought to be a hero. And was that, if you asked the right people, but, you know, had another side to him as well, shall we say. So I'm just curious what your take is, what that was like, that sort of psychological recovery for you that you gleaned at.
Yeah, this is why I had to change the whole focus of my book. Originally, I was going to write just a straight out biography of my grandfather and kind of make me the objective reporter. But I ended up deciding to make it a memoir and make it about my journey of discovery and how I went from denial to just slowly, slowly, slowly coming to terms with what my grandfather did. And then finally going, you know, with all engines, all jets going full force to find the truth. And that first part of it was extremely painful, emotionally, psychologically. I can't express how bad it was. And I don't know what even made me continue to keep going other than, and this is where, you know, I'm a practicing Catholic, and this is where I feel like my faith kicked in to give me what I needed, the resources, the psychological resources to really face the truth of what happened.
I understand that. Thank you, Sylvia. I'd love to talk about this because I think it's important. I'd love for our listeners to know. Could you talk a little bit about the work that you and Grant Gochin have been doing?
Yes. He's an amazing, amazing individual. We met in 2018. So I had been pretty much done with my book and I had done all my research. And then I needed to find a literary agent, you know, to get a publisher. And so I put up a website. And then within a day or two of putting up that website, I got an email from a researcher in Lithuania saying he works for a man by the name of Grant Gochin, who is launching a lawsuit against the Genocide Resistance and Research Center of Lithuania. We didn't even talk about that group. And he was suing them essentially for Holocaust distortion concerning my grandfather, because they were so instrumental in creating my grandfather as a hero. It was under their recommendation that he got that Cross of the Vitez, which is the highest honor that Lithuania gives to anyone posthumously. And so anyway, when I got that email, I almost fell off my chair, because at that point, I only thought the story was like only my grandfather. You know, I had come across other individuals, you know, Lithuanians involved in the Holocaust, and I had told myself, you know what? I'm just writing about my grandfather, no one else. I'm not really going to drag other people's names into it. But when I got involved with Grant, that's when I really realized that, you know, this is what we were talking about, psychology and the denial of it is at the governmental level. They can't face it.
Institutional.
Yes, it's institutional. And either they know and they're deliberately hiding it, or it's just psychological and they can't face it. Maybe it's a combination of the two.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Excellent. Well, I tell you, Sylvia, the book once again is called Storm in the Land of Rain. Sylvia Foti, how can people find out about you?
You can go to my website, Sylvia Foti. It's S-I-L-V-I-A-F-O-T, like Tom I.com. And of course, there's more information there than you ever would need to know about me. And, you know, everything's in the book. And I hope you enjoy it if you decide to read it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Sylvia. I really enjoyed speaking with you. I appreciate you taking the time for me.
Thank you, Joshua. I really enjoyed this too.
Oh, thank you. Take care, okay?
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. We can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.